This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, and I'm Joe Palca, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Humming isn't usually something that you associate with fish, but certain fish sing to find a mate. And I'm not talking about that singing, talking bass that your uncle gave you a few years ago. The male midshipman fish calls to the female of the species with a loud, steady humming, guiding her to a secluded nook under a rock where she can lay her eggs to be fertilized. But new research published this week in the journal Science indicates that the female midshipman fish can't hear that hum very well unless she's ready to mate. That hormonal change sharpens her ears at the critical time of the year. Want to talk about that? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. I mean, who wouldn't want to talk about a fish whose hearing changes in response to hormonal changes? I mean, what could be more peculiar, outre, unusual? And joining me to help explain it is Andrew Bass. He's a professor in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, where he's been studying these fish for the past 20 years. He's one of the authors on the paper in Science, and he joins me from a studio in Ithaca, New York. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
So, Dr. Bass, seriously, I mean, how do you get started on a research topic like this? I have to say, before I came to journalism, I was a sleep researcher, and I got a whole pile of people laughing at me saying how great I was in sleep and Dr. Sleep and ha, ha, ha. But if you say I study humming fish, you must take a certain amount of ribbing.
Always the case. Yeah, okay. You really have to justify it for sure.
Okay.
But the way I got involved in it, I was interested in sex differences in animals and hearing and sound production, and that's the way I got started on it.
Really? So, well, are there known sex differences in hearing in animals? I mean, I know, well, I don't want to be, you know, broad about this, but certainly men are accused of never hearing anything that a woman says, but I'm sure that's not what you mean.
Right. Certainly you hear lots of stories about humans when it comes to that.
Okay.
But there are
I'll stop.
Yeah. But there are cases reported in birds and other animals of differences in hearing ability. And they often occur at different times of the year, depending on whether or not the animals are in reproductive condition.
Really? And so what, I mean, is it a temperature-based change? Is it a physiological change? Are the bones different sizes? What's happening?
But that's a great question, because a lot of these animals, needless to say, live in environments where their temperature can rapidly change, and they're sensitive to those temperature changes. But what we've discovered is a change in the sense of hearing in these fish, which has nothing to do with temperature, and it's something that's really regulated by the hormones that are whose levels are fluctuating in their blood at different times of the year.
So how did you go about proving that it was the hormone and not something else that was changing the sensitivity to the sound?
Well, the way you go about doing a study like that is, needless to say, there's a lot of preliminary studies that lead up to it. So this was work that I did with a postdoc in my lab named Joe Cisneros. And what we did was we looked at the sense of hearing in normal animals, in normal females, that is, during the breeding season. And then we compared their sense of hearing to animals during the non-breeding season. And the way we're able to do that is using a method known as neurophysiology, in which you can go in and you can use electrodes to actually record the electrical activity that's coming from the ear in response to a sound stimulus. And when you do those kinds of experiments, you discover that, sure enough, the animal's sense of hearing is very different between the breeding season and the non-breeding season. And what that logically leads you to conclude is perhaps steroid hormones, which we know also fluctuate in this animal at different times of the year, perhaps they're a key molecule that might actually adjust the hearing sensitivity of this animal.
Hmm. And you found one.
We sure did. And so what we discovered was that two hormones, which are found in humans and all animals, known as testosterone and estrogen, which you hear about all the time in the newspapers, those two hormones can lead to changes in the sense of hearing, even in this fish and in females of the species. So that during the summer, when the animals are in breeding condition, they're more sensitive to the frequency components of the mate call of the species, which is the sound you've been playing for people on the radio.
Right. Well, that sound, maybe we can hear it one more time. That sound, we hear that in just a second. That sound, what part of it are the fish actually hearing? I mean, does that change, or would we be able to detect a change over time?
Well, yeah, you might be able to detect the change over time. It's certainly in the range of hearing of humans. And what's most unusual is that that sound, all sounds, first of all, are a mechanical disturbance. And they're made up of a family of frequencies. And there's one frequency that's known as a fundamental frequency. And then there are a series of other frequencies which are known as harmonics, which are multiples of that fundamental frequency. And it so happens that this animal's mate call has the fundamental and a series of very prominent harmonics, which are upper higher frequencies. And it turns out that that male is only making that mate call or advertisement call during the summer months when females are trying to find the males. And what happens is that the female's sense of hearing is not only sensitive to that fundamental frequency, but it's sensitive to the upper harmonics of the call. And that's what helps the female to find the male in his nesting area. Now, during the rest of the year, the animal, the female's sense of hearing, she's not so sensitive to those upper harmonics, which makes perfectly good sense because the males aren't mate calling at that time, and why invest energy in having an ear that's sensitive to those upper frequencies?
Although I don't know what kind of energy that is involved in, but never mind. I've asked enough questions. Let's let our listeners have a shot at this. Let's first go to Camille in Charleston, South Carolina. Camille, welcome to the program.
I love the topic. And I was wondering if any of your research has shown whether fish might be having trouble reproducing successfully because of all the noise from drilling and ships and engine and sonar that I know whales have had some trouble with.
Interesting. Camille, thanks for the question. What do you think about that, Dr. Mass?
That's an excellent question. Does anthropogenic sources of sound affect these animals? Well, over the years, we have not found that to be the case. And we've done a lot of our work is all on the West Coast, which is where these fish are found, in quite beautiful areas known as Tomales Bay, California, and also up in Washington State in the Puget Sound area. And what's remarkable is these animals actually live in very quiet environments. It's so quiet that on a summer's evening, if the water is still, you know, it's almost glass-like, you could actually hear that sound on shore. And sometimes, sure, you can hear a motorboat out there and something like that. But if anything, my impression over all these years is that this animal is becoming even more successful in its environment. So we have no indication that anything like that is happening with these animals.
Interesting. Let's go to Susan. Susan in Kansas City, Kansas, Missouri? I don't know. I guess Missouri, yes. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Actually, I'm a truck driver, and I'm crossing over from Missouri into Kansas even as we speak.
Well, there you go. So I was right both ways.
I find it interesting that this is the situation with the fish, but I find that people, I guess it would be a chicken and egg question, I don't know which came first, but people do exactly the same thing.
How do you mean?
Well, if someone is not in a position emotionally to accept an overture from a prospective mate, don't hear.
Right. But you're talking,
they literally do not hear the approach.
So you're thinking that it's not just that they're not interested, it's you're saying that it's actually at the, well, maybe I should put it to Dr. Bass. is it some difference in the auditory system of women who are not hormonally receptive that makes them deny the overture, or is there some higher level functioning going on?
It's not just women either, it's men also.
Well, true, but it's testosterone and estrogen. Well, so you could be. All right, so we'll let Dr. Bass have a whack at that.
Well, I think it's definitely some higher order cognitive function that's governing that decision.
But what do you think is doing it in the fish? Let's talk about that. What's going on? Is it a brain function or an ear function, or what is it in the fish?
It's probably a combination of the both in the following way. So that it appears from our work that the steroid hormones clearly affect the sensitivity of the ear itself to picking up sounds. But that information then has to be sent into the brain where it's processed, and that's where the decision-making units occur, or in the central nervous system in the brain itself. So it's really a complex process. But the first way station where we all hear sound is out at the ear, and that's clearly being adjusted in these animals on a seasonal basis. But in terms of those short-term cognitive decisions, I don't know that the hormones are going to be affecting humans in that way. The hormones can be affecting human hearing in other ways, certainly. But I don't think in that particular instance it might be happening.
Okay, Susan, thanks very much for the call, and drive safely.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. Before we go on, I think maybe you ought to tell us a little bit about the midshipman fish. What kind of a beast is it?
Well,
because I don't remember ever seeing a picture of one, you know, and they don't have them hanging in the wall here at NPR.
Right. They're not amongst those beautiful coral reef fishes, that's for sure. They're a very drab-colored looking fish, but they're very unusual in that during the winter months, they're deep offshore from the western coast of the United States. They may be as far down as 600 feet. And what happens is in the early spring and summer, they migrate from those deep offshore sites into the rocky intertidal zone, which is often exposed at low tides. And it's a very unusual behavior for an animal to pursue. And essentially, they're building their nest under those rocky shelters, which you described earlier. And it's from that cavern-like nest that they produce this mate call. It also so happens they're mainly active at night, and what a perfect environment for them to be using sound to try to attract a mate, because visual cues are not going to be that informative to them. And so they're really rather remarkable in that essentially their entire life revolves around making sound and hearing sound. That's what it's all about with these fish, and that's part of the reason I decided to study them a number of years ago, because I was really interested in finding a model system in which we could study hearing and mechanisms by which animals make sounds.
Let's go to Michael in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome to the program.
I can't tell you right to rest offhand like that.
Whoops. Michael, are you there? Or are you doing other things? Sounds like Michael's gotten distracted by other issues. Let's try Dave in Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Welcome to the program. What's your question?
All right. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I've seen lots of fish that do make noise, like dolphins and whatnot, but where are these fish's ears?
Ooh, well,
I've never seen, like, protruding.
Let's run for cover before we call a dolphin a fish.
But, yeah, mammals, but aquatic beings.
Right. Got it. Okay. Question then. Where are the ears on a midshipman fish?
That's a good question, and you're absolutely right. First of all, sound is well known among fishes. That's how fishermen often have been able to find fish in aggregations in the oceans. And this animal's ear is right below the surface of the skin, below its skull. Now, what you have to appreciate is this fish has an inner ear just as you do. It has all the same parts to its ear as you have, except for one thing. It doesn't have a cochlea. The cochlea is your main organ of hearing. But it uses another part of the inner ear, which is known as the sacculus, as its main organ of hearing. You also have a sacculus, which you mainly use for getting information about your position, the position of your body in three-dimensional space.
Oh, for,
and what they've
now,
simply
for
done
now,
is adopted it.
So,
go ahead.
Sorry, Dave, go ahead.
So that would be used in a human for balance and position if you're falling down, how to upright yourself. And
yeah, that's it, right.
Now,
exactly.
is there an orifice, like we have a hole in the middle of our ear, or is it just sealed over, but they can sense through that?
That's also a really good question. No, they don't have anything like that, no external orifice that you're thinking of in terms of humans. So the thing to appreciate is that in the water, it's essentially the sound, as I said earlier, is a mechanical disturbance, and it's literally vibrating the water particles around it. And the fish's entire body vibrates together with those water particles. It's in motion with it. And essentially, there are specializations in the inner ear that allow the ear to detect those vibrations in the sound, in the surrounding water. So literally, the signal is translated right across the animal's body into its ear.
Dave, thanks very much for the call, but I think you better move to California. You need water, my friend. Thanks very much. And I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this part of our discussion. Andrew Bass is a professor in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us this hour.
And thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. And when we come back, there will be another fish story. What's for dinner? Red snapper or red herring? Stay with us and give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 989-TALK. Don't go away. From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. When you go to the supermarket, you know that a piece of beef on display is probably beef. And there's an excellent chance that a package of chicken does, in fact, contain chicken. But does that hold true when you stop by the fish counter? New research published this week in the journal Nature might give you some food for thought. Joining me now to talk about it is Peter Marco. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Marine Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He joins me by phone from his office there. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for inviting me.
And if you want to talk with Dr. Marco and me about this issue of when is a snapper not a snapper, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And so tell us, I mean, as I understand it, you didn't go out with this little project that you published to, in order to prove a point about red snapper. You were doing just a lab experiment to get a little practice for your graduate students. Is that right?
The project started out as a group project for a class that I teach called Molecular Population Biology. What it is it's a class where students interested in questions of ecology, evolution, and conservation can learn how to use molecular biology techniques to approach those sorts of questions. And so these are my areas of specialization. And a fellow faculty member who's a co-author on the study suggested to me that we look at seafood substitution, because there's all kinds of stories out there about one species being substituted for others that are more highly prized.
So give us the protocol. You went to the stores in various places and you bought fish, is that right?
Yeah, so the students and myself, we bought mostly whole fillets of fish from grocery stores from 8 different states in the U.S. Some students bought the fish when they went home to visit their folks during breaks in classes, and we had some people send us some samples from other states as well.
Must have been a popular mail room at North Carolina Fish coming in through the mail. So what did you do once the samples arrived? How do you go about testing the DNA in a fish fillet?
Well, what we did is the reason we could do this project was that someone else had already done a study of the evolutionary relationships of species in this family of fish called snappers, and they had sequenced a gene called cytochrome B. So what we did is that we took the tissue samples from the fish, extracted their DNA, and amplified this gene, cytochrome B, and sequenced it. And then we used the sequences from this previous study as a set of reference sequences so that we could then line up and match our sequences to those using what are sort of called evolutionary tree-building methods to identify the sequences.
So, in other words, it was possible to say same or different between, I mean, presumably if you had the same fish as the reference sample, you'd just say, well, this is the same fish, right?
Right. So, for example, we found some fish that were, in fact, red snapper, and they differed from, the DNA sequences from our samples differed from these reference sequences by just a couple of DNA nucleotide substitutions. And so that amount of variation, that amount of genetic variation, is well within the range that you normally see in most fish species. So we could be quite confident in identifying sequences as belonging to particular species if they were really close in terms of their sequence similarity.
So how many fish did you actually get a chance to study, and what were the numbers like?
Well, in total, we got 22 fish, and it turned out that 17 of them were not red snapper. They turned out to be other species of fish.
Huh.
So 77% of the fish turned out to be mislabeled or misbranded.
Right. So what do you conclude from that? I mean, I've heard that, you know, there's a temptation to say, there's, you know, 3/4 of the fish are, that we think is red snapper is not red snapper, but I presume that's not really what you're saying here.
Well, what we can say about that frequency is that we calculated a margin of error statistic, the same sort of statistic that you see that is produced with, say, surveys or polls, political polls. And our margin of error for this study was about 17%, which is quite large. But even though there was a large margin of error, we can still confidently say then that the actual frequency of mislabeled fish falls somewhere between 60% and 94%. So another way of thinking about it is that if we repeated the same study with 22 fish 100 times, we would then expect to get a mean frequency of mislabeled fish to fall between 60 and 94%, about 95 in 95 times out of those 100 separate experiments.
Got it. I remember those statistical confidence intervals. All right. Well, let's see what people have to say about that. Our number here is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And let's go to Didier in Jacksonville. I guess that must be Florida. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I own a seafood market. It's called the Seafood Gourmet, and I sell most all my fish with the skin on.
Ah.
There are a variety of different types of snappers that are basically from offshore here in Jacksonville. We've got red snapper, vermilion snapper, mangrove snapper, mutton snapper, hog snapper, yellowtail snapper. And the best way to see what kind of fish you have is to see, look at it with the skin on, or to see it whole.
Right. Now, but now, just to be clear, the sampling that Dr. Bass did and his students was in filleted fish, so that they were operating at that disadvantage of not being able to see by the way the skin looked.
You can still leave the skin on and still be able to determine what it is. Because most people, I mean, if they go to a seafood market, and they like to grill their fish, and you're going to grill the fish with the skin on. You're not going to take it off. Especially if you're going to put it directly on the grill.
Well, maybe I could ask you then, as a fish expert, is there, besides a taste difference between red snapper and other fish, are there financial issues to be thought about here?
Not really.
So red snapper doesn't cost significantly more than other fish?
Oh, yeah. As far as other fish, absolutely.
Oh, it does cost more?
Sure it does.
So what's red snapper going for today?
Today's red snapper? We're talking filleted here without any bones because I do remove the bones.
Uh-huh.
Today's price is $13.95 a pound.
And let me then go ask Dr. Bass, can you tell what some of the substitution fish were, or all you know from your study is it wasn't red snapper?
I'm flattered that you're calling me Dr. Bass, but it's Dr. Marco.
Oh, sorry. I'm so sorry. One segment passed.
I'm sorry. What was your question again?
Well, Dr. Marco, the question is, when you knew that the samples you were getting were not red snapper, did you know what they were, or all could you only say they weren't red snapper?
Well, because we had this nice data set of reference sequences, we thought that we were going to be able to identify most of the species. And it did turn out that we could be confident in identifying some of the species that were not red snapper. So, for example, three we think, or we're pretty confident, are a species called vermilion snapper. A couple others are sequences are very close to another species called lane snapper, and so we think those are lane snapper. And then another couple are from a species called crimson snapper. But about half of the samples that we obtained turned out to have DNA sequences that didn't really closely match any of these reference sequences from Western Atlantic species.
I got it. So here's the question I want to put now to Didier in Jacksonville. What's vermilion snapper going for today?
About the same price.
Really?
Yes.
So is this may just be mislabeling through incompetence as opposed to mislabeling through financial greed?
I don't think the good doctor is going to deny that both of them are not snappers.
Uh-huh.
Oh, absolutely. That's an important point to make, that all of our samples turned out to be snappers, and they're all pretty good-tasting fish.
And may I ask, were the fish that you received shell-on? I mean, not shell-on, I'm sorry, skin-on or skin-off? Or?
Yeah, I believe every single one of them was skin-on, so we had the skin as well.
Okay.
And did you have it as a whole fish, or was it filleted when you got it?
The majority of the samples were whole fillets, but a couple of the fish were whole fish.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to move on from this topic, because what we're trying to figure out here, I guess, is the significance of this happening. I mean, Dr. Marco, you've made an observation, and the interesting question is, what's going on here? What do you think is going on?
Well, our study didn't really address why so many fish in our sample were mislabeled. So we can't really answer that question. We know, however, that fish could be mislabeled or misbranded at any point between the time they're caught and the time they're put on ice in a grocery store or at a restaurant. So it's something that our study didn't ask, but we just merely raised the issue of where are these fish being mislabeled, and it's something that we'd very much like to know.
Okay, let's hear what other questions people might have. Let's go to Mike in New Jersey. Mike, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you today?
Thanks, I'm fine.
My question is, I've always heard a myth about sea scallops. If they were all the same size, that they may be shark. They'd have to be different sizes.
Shark.
They were like stamped out. I don't know if that was true or not.
I've heard that before too. Dr. Marco, do you have any perspective on that? I know you weren't looking at shark in this particular one or scallops, but maybe you've heard that same thing.
Yeah, I had heard that for many years too and didn't know if that was myth or reality. But then it turns out that a colleague of mine here in our department used to work in the seafood business, and he said that they would routinely chop skate wings. A skate is a shark, a fish related to sharks, kind of like a ray with large wings. And they would chop with sort of a cookie cutter round segments out of these skate wings and sell them as scallops. So that apparently that is true.
Do you see a possibility that you're entering a world as a fish detective here, Dr. Marco? You know, is that a possibility?
I don't know, but we are doing a few similar projects in the lab related to this that I guess could be classified as fish forensics.
Interesting. Let's go to Jay in Naples, Florida. Jay, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're most welcome. Go ahead.
My question is, I've bought red snapper, or what I thought was red snapper, in a variety of local supermarkets down here, and it seems every time I get one, it has a different flavor, different texture. It'll react differently to different methods of cooking. Does that also have to go along with what your study has found? Would that change the taste of the fish, obviously?
Well, that sort of sounds what I personally have experienced buying fish myself, is that when I buy red snapper, I found it to be a little bit different every time I get it. And in the past, I've assumed that that maybe has had more to do with refrigeration. But perhaps it may be that it's because each time you buy it, you might be getting a slightly different species. So I tend to think that maybe there's a reason for that observation.
Excellent.
Interesting.
The question about scallops, I was a professional chef, and you always knew if you had a real scallop, it had the muscle on the side of it that it was cut out from the shell from.
Oh, yeah, I think that's true.
Exactly, yeah.
I used to catch scallops as a child. I think I could always tell the difference, but, you know, probably not. It's just a conceit. There is a serious issue behind all, but there's a broader issue behind knowing what kind of fish are coming into the market, and that's this business of trying to assess the fish stocks are actually out there. I mean, if people are saying, oh, we caught, you know, X number of red snapper, and they're really catching a vermilion snapper or some other kind, I should think that would have a major impact in the way fishing is moderated.
It is, and it's a complex issue, and it's one that our study doesn't really address, but we did raise that issue. And it's not that the frequencies of these different types of fish in groceries or supermarkets might affect scientists' perception of how big natural stocks of these species are. Fishery managers make their own surveys, but they also of natural populations, but they also use catch data, which are usually collected by fish dealers in places called fish houses and submitted to regulatory agencies. And so we were a little bit concerned that if perhaps mislabeling occurs relatively early on in the commercial fishing process, that some fish could be recorded as species that they aren't actually, and that therefore that could potentially bias this kind of catch data. But we really don't know to what extent that bias might actually exist.
We're talking about mislabeling of fish that you might be finding in your supermarket. Our number is 800-989-8255, and I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation. Let's take a call from John in Florida. John, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call here.
You're welcome.
I have been a captain and a commercialman for a number of years, and a number of things that I've seen in fish markets, retail, grocery stores and stuff, is even with the skin on, you will rarely see the fish with the scales. I've seen yellowtail snappers scaled with a red snapper tag in it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the color goes away. You take a lot of fish, and their colors are in the scales. So you scale that fish skin on, sometimes it gets very difficult to tell. And many of the and at what level? Personally, I think it's at all levels.
Really?
I have seen, I have not done it myself because I have no need to, but I have seen people take Nassau groupers, which are totally banned from being kept at all, taken to a market, filleted, and slapped right out right there. The commercialman knew it, and the guy at the retail knew that that was an illegal grouper. I have seen so many things like this go on that it's just mind-boggling, and it's if there's a buck to be made. Snook, which is a highly recreational fish in Florida since the 60s, no commercial fishing whatsoever. Many, many times I have known people, commercialmen, to catch big snook, take them to restaurants, and they were sold as grouper.
Hmm. John, thanks for that perspective. I'm just wondering, Dr. Marco, have you been getting calls from regulatory agencies, you know, asking for more work on this particular issue?
No. We've been getting some emails and phone messages from people that have worked in the regulatory agencies and in the fishing industry in the past to tell us about their experiences. And we've heard lots of different stories about where this kind of mislabeling would occur. But we've also heard from all kinds of – we've heard from management agencies this week about how they go to great lengths to avoid misidentification and mislabeling. And we've also heard from seafood retailers that they only purchase properly labeled seafood. And in some ways, it does sort of sound like it's a bit of a hot potato that everyone is trying to pass around. And, you know, the fact remains that we've found all these mislabeled fish in our sample.
John, we have time for one more quick call from John in Las Vegas. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Basically, I worked for a fresh fish market in Seattle, and evidently any of the fish that they pick up on the bottom, if the meat is white, they'll use it not only for cod, but red meat will go to snapper, and they really won't differentiate between the two, and that's a lot of different fish markets that do that.
Yep.
Happens all the time, as a matter of fact. And the average customer won't be able to discern with the skin off what fish they're getting. If they see the white meat, they think it's cod. If they see the red meat, they think it's snapper or the pinkish-colored meat. So it happens a lot.
Okay, John, thanks for that call. Dr. Marco, I guess that's what you're there to figure out if you can do anything about, but I'm afraid we've run out of time. Thanks very much for talking with me.
Okay, well, thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. Peter Marco is an assistant professor in the Department of Marine Sciences at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill and one of the authors of a paper on red snapper in the journal Nature. For the rest of this hour, yet another fish story. Well, perhaps we're stretching. We'll be talking jellyfish. There are reports of unusually large numbers of jellyfish off British coasts this summer, to the point that the UK's Marine Conservation Society is asking the public to report jelly sightings to help to try to identify the cause. The jellies spotted in the thousands include the large stinging lion's mane jellyfish, immortalized in a Sherlock Holmes adventure of the same name.
Slowly I walked around the edge of the water, my comrades in Indian file behind me. Most of the pool was quite shallow, but under the cliff where the beach was hollowed out, it was 4 or 5 feet deep. It was to this part that a swimmer would naturally go, for it formed a beautiful, pellucid green pool, as clear as crystal. A line of rocks lay above it, at the base of the cliff, and along this I led the way, peering eagerly into the depths beneath me. I had reached the deepest and stillest pool, when my eyes caught that for which they were searching, and I burst into a shout of triumph. "Syenia!" I cried. "Syenia! Behold the lion's mane!" The strange object at which I pointed did indeed look like a tangled mass torn from the mane of a lion. It lay upon a rocky shelf, some 3 feet under the water, a curious, waving, vibrating, hairy creature, with streaks of silver among its yellow tresses. It pulsated with a slow, heavy dilation and contraction. "It has done mischief enough. Its day is over." "Well, this gets me," cried the inspector. "What was it, Mr. Holmes? I'm born and bred in these parts, but I never saw such a thing. It don't belong to Sussex."
Turns out that the jellyfish was the murderer in this story, not a jealous lover who was accused in the case. Sherlock Holmes may have solved that particular problem, but as my next guest will testify, there's a lot about jellyfish that remains a mystery. Joining me now to talk about jellies is Claudia Mills. She's an independent research scientist based at the Friday Harbor Laboratories, and she joins me by phone from Friday Harbor, Washington. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Joe. Glad to be here.
So are you at all surprised to hear that Sherlock Holmes at the turn of the century was finding lion's mane, is it Syenia or Syenia, a jellyfish on the coasts of Surrey?
I call it Syenia.
Uh-huh.
No, this is a species that is found all the way around the northern part of the world oceans. The same species occurs in the Pacific as the Atlantic, and they're there.
Uh-huh. So what's up with jellyfish? I mean, are they on the rise? Are we really seeing more globally than we used to?
Well, this is a very difficult question, which I've spent a good part of the past several years trying to figure out. I can't tell if there's more globally or whether we're just more aware of them. There are certainly more in some localities than there used to be. We know so little about jellyfish in most parts of the world that it's very hard to figure out. One of my favorite issues is that moon jellies, these are white jellyfish about 6 inches to a foot across, which are probably introduced in bays and nearshore areas throughout the world, probably most Aurelias, the moon jelly, mm-hmm. are from Northern Europe. And it turns out they are shutting down power plants all over the world. When they bloom, it's usually a spring or summer phenomenon. And the question is, which was there first, the jellies or the power plants? What we seem to be seeing is that a new power plant goes in a developing country, at which point you start seeing power outages. Half the grid of the Philippines was taken out by a moon jelly bloom maybe 5 years ago. And so it's a little difficult to say which came first. It may be that new power stations are only showing up something that's been there for a long time.
Interesting. If you have a question about jellyfish and knowing maybe you know of a jellyfish story you'd like to share, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And maybe you can give us some facts on jellyfish. I mean, I presume not all jellyfish are alike. When I was growing up, jellyfish were a thing to be feared because of the sting. Do all jellyfish sting?
Most jellyfish don't sting. There's maybe 1,000 species. I mostly know about the tiny ones that are a couple of inches in diameter and less, but the ones that are most newsworthy are the ones that are on the 1 foot, 2 foot, even washing machine sized. There was a bloom off Japan in the sort of late fall last year that they were being described as looking like washing machines.
Washing machines?
Yeah, really good, huh? These are 2 meters across, enormous red jellyfish that actually are edible.
I'm sorry, I'm stuck on edible yeah. washing machines. That's
yeah.
And I have to stop for a second. You mean people, how do people eat them? Do they just have globs on their plate? You know, do you eat it like, do you put it in an ice cube tray or something?
No, there's many groups of jellyfish, but some are very cartilaginous. They're quite firm when you touch them, and they dry down to be much more substantial than the sort of formless ones that we know in the temperate waters. These sort of hard cartilaginous ones are mostly tropical, and they dry them down and treat them somehow with alum. There's a fishery for jellyfish throughout a lot of Southeast Asia for the Chinese and Japanese market. And I was at a seminar where a Chinese woman was talking about them, and she said it's about the crunch.
The crunch.
This is what we're going for among the people that appreciate this as a dinnertime aperitif, I suppose it would be.
I see. And why do you think, I mean, why is this a great neglected area of marine biology, the jellyfish?
There are not a lot of us doing it. The real neglected area is these big ones that are probably the ones that are ecologically important, and they're just horrendous to work on. I mean, these things are...
You need a big tank.
You
need a big tank.
You need a big tank. You need strong arms. You can't even get them in a bucket. They're sort of garbage can material. There's a woman working off the coast of Oregon looking at diets of actually lion's manes off Oregon, and it's taking her 2 or 3 days to go through the... They've got these long, frilly oral lobes, they're called, that hang down in the center of a jellyfish, and the whole thing is the sort of stomach surface, and it's taking her days to go through each animal to see what they're eating. They're very intractable.
Strange. Okay, well, I invited listeners to join this conversation at 989-8255. That's 989-TALK, and I'll be good to my word. Let's go first to Ed in Hampton, Virginia. Ed, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you very much. Grew up down here on the coast, Chesapeake Bay area, and spent our lives dodging jellyfish and getting stung and on and on. And I have a question. Is there any link between water quality and what appears to be, or is there an increasing number of jellyfish along the East Coast or any of the coasts due to water quality?
Interesting, Ed. Good question. What do you make of that, Dr. Mills?
Well, one of the things that I've heard but never actually seen in writing about the Chesapeake Bay is that with the oysters largely gone from the bay, that there's much higher phytoplankton concentrations than there used to be.
Phytoplankton are
the single-celled plant cells, single-celled plants that float around in the water and which shellfish generally filter out of the water. That's their primary food source. And that makes for a very large change in water quality and sort of food chain dynamics. So, yes, there may be more jellyfish because of that as a sort of third or fourth order effect. In the Chesapeake Bay, actually, there's now a jellyfish prediction service, which you can get on the Internet. It's called coastwatch.noaa.gov/seanettles, and there's a predictor based on salinity and temperature of where you will be most likely to encounter Chesapeake Bay sea nettles. It's a weekly predictor. It's a model that's based on temperature and salinity.
Yeah, I've actually seen that because people were going to be able to decide where to swim based on the water temperature and salinity in the bay. We're not too far from the Chesapeake here in Washington, D.C.
So those are water quality issues. They're actually pretty simple ones and apparently fairly good predictors.
Interesting. Let's go to Paul in South Bend, Indiana. Paul, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Hello to Dr. Mills. I used to fish up there by Friday Harbor for rock cod all the time. I'm now a transplanted Midwesterner. So my question was basically what the actual mechanism for when the jellyfish had to bloom. I'm assuming that the large numbers are plugging up the vents of the power plant, but the actual mechanism of...
Oh, yeah. In other words, how does a jellyfish knock out a power plant?
Yeah.
Good question.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they screw up the heating system, the cooling systems, by just, you're right, filling the screens.
Okay, so very similar to the way the mussels out here have clogged up power plants as well.
Yeah, very different mechanism, but that's exactly right. Just right. Having too many of them in the screen.
Paul, thanks very much for the call. I need to remind people that I'm Joe Palca, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to the phones, and Leslie in Tucson, Arizona. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've been a big fan of jellyfish ever since I saw the exhibit at the Monterey Aquarium a number of years ago. It was just fantastic. My husband and I went to Belize a number of years ago and saw a thing in the water. It was a bright green, almost like laser pointer intensity, and they were dancing back and forth, and one would go, then another, and the locals had no idea what it was, and I was curious, was that a jellyfish?
Was it night?
It was.
They probably, it's a wild guess, I'm guessing they're ostracods, which are a kind of crustacean related more sort of to crabs.
Okay.
Which have bioluminescent signaling and which I think respond to each other. Jellyfish also can give off light at night, but they don't respond to each other at all. In fact, it's pretty hard. I've done a lot of looking in the dark in tanks, wanting to see these things bioluminesce, and there's very little autoluminescence. It seems to be, if you give them a prod, a jellyfish will flash, and let's say half the species can do it. But they don't seem to go off on their own for no apparent reason, and ostracods would.
Okay.
What is an ostracod?
They're related to amphipods. They're very small crustaceans, let's say. Laser size seems really about right, a few millimeters.
It started out in the center of the structure and then went out in a circular pattern from there. They were floating on the top of the water, kind of bumping against this dock.
Well, it's a mystery. Leslie, you're going to have to keep looking for the answer to that question, I think.
Yeah.
Go back to Belize, I think.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take one more quick call from Sopo in Alvord, Iowa. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
What's your question?
If you get stung by a jellyfish, how do you take away the sting?
Ah, the classic question. And do you have an answer, Dr. Mills?
I do have an answer.
Okay.
I was reading, expecting this question.
Good.
If you're in the United States, you're not probably going to get any serious damage from jellyfish. And apparently the short answer is aspirin.
Aspirin.
Or your favorite ibuprofen, aspirin, whatever you like to take for.
So nothing topical. You're recommending the systemic treatment.
It's apparently the fastest and most reliable. Heat or cold packs work. And if you're in the Chesapeake Bay, apparently a 50% solution of seawater and baking soda may help. But mostly it's aspirin and thyme, and we're talking 3 or 4 hours.
So, Paul, I have to ask, you're in Iowa. Where do you worry about jellyfish?
Well, I am going to California.
Ah, okay. All right, makes sense. We'll have a nice trip.
Yeah.
We have time for one more quick call. Let's go to John in Jacksonville, Florida. Go ahead, please. John?
No, this is Brendan from Nantucket.
Ah, well, I punched the wrong button. Brendan from Nantucket. Welcome to the program.
Do jellyfish sting each other?
Do jellyfish sting each other? Thanks very much for that question, Dr. Mills.
Hey, I may know the answer to that.
Oh, good.
Using a scanning electron microscope and looking for something entirely different on the surfaces of jellyfish, we sometimes run into rows of nematocysts, the stinging cells, which are probably tracks left of the tentacle of some other species. So, yes, I think they do, and probably they have no effect. The toxins, well, some jellyfish eat each other. Many jellyfish have diets of jellyfish, so for sure they sting each other.
Interesting. So what do you do next? What's your research right at the moment?
I'm actually looking at declines in jellyfish locally, a jellyfish that is responsible for green fluorescent protein and a bioluminescent protein that are both used in medicine and both have now been cloned. It used to be exceedingly common here, and the numbers have fallen dramatically, and I'm very curious why. It's got to be some basic water quality issue or maybe a climate change.
Well, it sounds like an interesting question. Maybe we can have you back to answer it sometime. I'd like to thank you for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Claudia Mills is an independent research scientist based at the Friday Harbor Laboratories in Washington. And earlier today, I spoke with Peter Marco, assistant professor in the Department of Marine Sciences at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and with Andrew Bass, a professor in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. Kevin Waite is our technical director. We had help today from audio engineer Vince Muse and Casey Parkin here in Washington and from Burt Reed in Ithaca. Greg Smith composed our theme music. Christopher Turpin was our fictional detective. We had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. If you have questions or comments, write to us at Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. You can also email us at scifry@npr.org or surf over and visit our website at www.sciencefriday.com. For NPR News in Washington, I'm Joe Palca.